informative, and engaging. Rick Munn. Rick Munn on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Monday, 15th of April, Anno Domini 2024. This is TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Rick Munn. This is Locked and Loaded. And yeah, whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, and whatever you're doing, we hope it's nice and, of course, legal. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the next 2 hours of who knows what. Who knows what, indeed. Well, I know what's what. I know we've got some great guests coming up. We've got Gemma Cooper coming up. And we've got all the breaking news we're going to be covering. A lot of wide topics today. We've got Robert Olds coming on at around about 20 past this hour. He is an author, a director of the Bruges Group, and also talking about culture wars, what's going on in Britain at the minute, what to look forward to this year or not to look forward this year in terms of elections. And then, of course, Basil Valentin and I will be talking at the end of the first hour, probably going to be focusing very heavily on the events of the weekend in the Middle East, of course, Iran and Israel, what's happening there, the wider fallout for that, for example, with oil prices. And they've actually went down a little bit over the weekend, but in anticipation of what Israel may or may not do next. So that's in the first hour of the show today. In the second hour, I'm going to be joined by Niall Fraser for the first time. He is a political analyst and a member of the Scottish Family Party. Going to be giving us a little bit of lowdown on what's happening up in Scotland. And then to round off the show today, Catherine McBean will be joining me. She is the founder of the People's Food and Farmers Alliance. And actually, we're going to be looking at a very hot topic today, which is geoengineering. Once dismissed as a complete and utter conspiracy, but no, doing a little bit of digging over the weekend. And actually, if you go back, well, quite some time now, there's papers published with commentaries from Harvard University professors, Oxford University, Cambridge University professors. Not that that necessarily means anything, but they're talking about the dire need to get something in place ASAP. And some of these papers, one of which I'm going to be delving into, was published in 2019. So that was 5 years ago, and they said we need to do something within the next 10 years. So by my reckoning, we are at the halfway point on that one. So that is all to come later on in the show. Now, of course, over the weekend as well, headlines were coming out, breaking news about the Mall Westfield Bondi Junction incident over the weekend where people were stabbed, and there's been a big fallout as a result of that. One of which is the New South Wales state government is providing $18 million in funding for an independent coronial inquest into the Westfield Bondi Junction tragedy on Saturday, according to Nine News in Sydney. Now, of course, what can you do? We've had so many shootings that have happened in so many schools in America and across the world, random terrorist attacks, suicide bombers, stabbings are going on left, right and centre in Europe. Now we have this tragedy over in Australia. But what's the fallout here? Will the government want to throw money at this? And what will it accomplish exactly? That's what people are asking the question. This is the question that's being asked. So as a response to this particular story, some of the comments were maybe put the $18 million into mental health funding that may prevent another tragedy like this happening. Someone else says, what would that do? Make the government find more reason to take away rights from us? How come they never put a cent into vaccine injuries or death inquiries? And somebody has pointed out that the excess deaths in Australia is currently in the tens of thousands, but there doesn't seem to be any dire need to investigate that yet after this incident at the weekend in Sydney Bondi attack. They're asking, well, why is $18 million all of a sudden being thrown into this and being treated for? Obviously, emotions are running very, very high. I'm just feeding back what I'm reading here. Someone said, why would you need $18 million except perhaps to pay off payoffs and cover-ups? Someone else said, that's a ridiculous amount of money. Not sure what they will tell us, what we don't already know. Some of that money could go to the families who have lost loved ones, provide counselling, etc. Also, they will probably end up now putting more security at shopping centres, more surveillance, and employ more police officers. So tensions are running very, very high, obviously, on this one over the weekend. So I'm just giving you a little bit of feedback on what I've been reading on this morning. to be honest, I've been pretty switched off over the weekend, which is no bad thing necessarily. So I'm just trying to get up to speed with everything that's going on this morning. Also, one other story here, Dr. Bruce Scott, who's a regular here on Locked and Loaded on TNT, he highlighted something here. This is crazy. These EVs, the push for EVs and, you know, greenness, control the climate. People with no driveways, what are they supposed to do? Well, there's a new initiative has been set up here. I can't decide if I like these or not. They solve the solution of cables on the pavement, but by making drivers feel even more entitled to space outside their house. Do you know what this is now that they've started to install? You know those self car washes where you park up and there's like a big long hose to spray the water and another big long hose with a big brush attached to it and it hangs over the top of the car? Well, that's what they're installing in some places in England now. These overhead chargers. And now people are saying, well, what if I can't get a space outside my house? What if somebody hogs my space? I can't charge my car up. And old Bruce Scott, bless him, has said, looks like a vandal's paradise. They shut the public toilets due to vandals. So I'm pretty sure charging points on the street will be prime meat to some idiots out there, and I have to concur. I would agree with that one, Bruce. Also, there's an article that I have here that I'll maybe go into in a little bit more detail with Gemma. The EV sales, and this is something that her and I have mapped out pretty much over the last 6 months since she joined TNT, about the decline and the unraveling of the EV industry, especially in Ireland. So we'll maybe take a brief pause and welcome the one and only Gemma Cooper, our sterling, stalwart news correspondent here, to take the stage to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help her God, don't go away. We'll be right back on TNT, Today's News Talk.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do Gemma a favor. She's spluttering and she's struggling this morning. She's got something up, and I can see her reaching for the mute button. I had to do this all last week. Every time I wanted to cough, I had to reach for the mute button, and it was like my face was going like this. But you couldn't hear anything because it was red in the mute button on and off. So, Gemma, I'm just going to say welcome to the show. I've got a story here I think you might like to hear about. Will I tell you about it?
Excuse me. Go on then.
Okay. Here's a story. For you this morning, you just sit back and relax and enjoy this. Electric vehicle sales are plummeting in Ireland. This is a story that's breaking this morning. Breaking news this morning here in Ireland and across the world. Peter Rand, Grip Media, looks at why. So here's the bottom line, Gemma. This is what's happening in Ireland at the minute. And of course, everything's reflected in sales. We can talk about what we think is happening in the world, but it's ultimately reflected in sales. So EV sales are plummeting in Ireland. New EV registrations are down a whopping 40% from this time last year, according to the Society of the Irish motor industry. However, the Irish establishment has continually promoted EVs as part of their larger climate change agenda. Green Party leader Eamon Ryan has promised a €100 million plan to promote EVs. How can EV adoption in Ireland be diminishing when the propaganda and subsidies are all pushing for it? So €100 million in towards promoting it. And after that, sales have dropped by a whopping 40% year on year, and I'm sure they will continue to fall here in Ireland. Doesn't add up.
Doesn't add up. We saw this coming, didn't we, Rick? We looked at the EV market in the UK, Ireland. I mean, we can see global sales, we can see factories and manufacturers pulling out of expansion plans to make different vehicles. We always knew that this was going to be on the cards. I think the nicest thing about it is it's happened so fast and so many people seeing through the EV agenda and what it means for control of movement and transport and how easily it can be switched. Excuse me, on and off. So it's a good news story for a Monday morning, just looking at the demise, not just in Ireland, but around the world. And I have got some other headlines too to bring to the table if we have time. But yeah, nice one for kicking off the week after such awful events at the weekend. On a positive note, you know, it is important to sort of talk about good news where we get it. And I'll be happy when there's no more EVs at all. That's it. End of. Done. Yeah. I don't know where we're going to put them all, how we're going to scrap them. But that's my kind of little hope for the future of this year anyway. But staying with events of the weekend, I mean, most of the headlines are dominated in the UK about Dave Cameron, our unelected foreign secretary, saying under no circumstances should we escalate the conflict between Iran and Israel, despite the fact we sent some RAF Typhoon jets over there at the weekend to help. So we're escalating it by not escalating it. I can't figure that one out myself. Also, interestingly, my money's on this, Rick, and I'll see what you think. Old dodgy Dave Cameron was asked this morning in the UK, you know, would you be prime minister again? And he said, absolutely not, under no circumstances. My money is that he's going to be the new leader by the end of the year because the Conservatives will lose the election. And then the next election after that, he will be PM again. I'll buy you a pint. I can see it coming. In a minute, a politician says, I'm not going to do something, that means they're going to do it. Also staying with the events of the weekend, the television presenter, Rachel Riley, who presents a show over here, a well-known show, she's facing calls to be sacked by her employer after a tweet she made at the weekend about the knife attacks in Sydney. She says they were misunderstood and she apologised about that. She tried to falsely link them to terrorism and to Islamophobia. That's what she's been accused of. And she says today that she is sorry. It was a misunderstanding. She's since removed the tweet. And also, police in Ireland, Irish police, are investigating a suspected arson attack at a property in Newton Mount Kennedy. It was earmarked for asylum seekers. There's been a series of protests outside that building, and police have confirmed today they are investigating it and looking at it as if it is arson. So we should know more about that over the next few days, Rick.
Yeah, indeed. That's the situation over there or over here, Jim, that's in development. The security firms are being brought in. The residents are just beside themselves at the thought of, another dumping of men into their communities. The politicians are taking no notice whatsoever of their fears and concerns. They're not being addressed by the police either. The police actually seem to be facilitating this. Of course, they're just puppets of the state. No doubt that story will continue to develop over this week. And interestingly, just to wrap this up about Dave Cameron, you know, as you were talking about him, you know, back in the day, horror movies, there was never just one of them. You know, you had Halloween, then Halloween 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Halloween H2O, and then Halloween Kills Halloween. Michael Myers just wouldn't go away. Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th franchise, I think they made about 8 of those movies. And of course, who can forget Freddy Krueger from the Nightmare on Elm Street? That guy just wouldn't go away no matter what you did to him. I think David Cameron is fast becoming the Michael Myers of British politics. Imagine seeing him walking back into number 10 again with that smug-ass grin on his face and his wife, Sam Cam. Remember Sam Cam? The pair of them used to cycle around together. Just Call Me Dave and Sam Cam, the hip and happening couple. Well, imagine them back in number 10. Listen, if Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger, and Michael Myers, and even Jaws, let's not forget that amphibious villain, Jaws. How many Jaws movies were made? If they can all do it, surely it's not beyond the realms of possibility that David Cameron could do the same. David Cameron, the revenge. I can just see it now, coming soon to a number 10 near you. Interesting that one. And who knows? It could happen by year end, Gemma. Stranger things have happened. So thank you so much for your input. I know you're feeling very poorly this morning. You're an absolute trooper. So we'll hopefully, fingers crossed, see you for another brief stint in the second Locked and Loaded, and then we'll go from there. So Gemma Cooper, thank you very much. Got to take a break and welcome Robert Oles to take the stage. Don't go away. Stay tuned for more here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
There was a plan on the British side to immediately after the victory over Germany to continue the war to push the weakened Soviet Union back over backwards. Yeah, so that is something that is not well known. That plan has been, you could find it on the internet, and then it's off and on sometimes again. It's very difficult. It's not long. It's something like, if I recall correctly, something of 30 pages, I would say. I read it.
The Soviets had this coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. And that appeared as the Soviets really was pushing forward, and they thought that this means that we have to start an alliance against the Soviets. And that what NATO became.
The Dirk Pollman Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Internet. A stream online.
TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Yes, today's News Talk TNT. This is Locked and Loaded. I'm Rick Munn, and I'm happy to be joined this morning by Robert Ulls. Robert is a director of the Bruges Group and also an author, several books, one of which is Everything You Wanted to Know About the EU, But Were Afraid to Ask, and also, more recently, World War II, The First Culture War. So welcome to Locked and Loaded this morning. Robert, how are you doing this beautiful spring day?
Weather here is awful, but very pleased to be on the show.
Yeah, the weather's horrific here too, but I'm trying to be as optimistic as possible. I'm looking out at grey skies, pissing rain, and I'm saying, yeah, it's a beautiful day because it's like this every day here in Ireland. Otherwise, I would lose my mind. So listen, welcome to the show anyway. Robert, plenty to talk about here this morning, both within the UK and obviously on the wider world stage at this point in time. One headline that took my attention yesterday, it read like this: Churchill would spin in his grave. A furious clash over the European Court of Human Rights suppressing democracy in the UK following Brexit. So Tory ministers, MPs have hit out at the ECHR after it issued a landmark ruling that governments have a duty to protect people from the effects of climate change, as well as interfering in asylum seeking and deportations and one thing and another. How overreaching have the ECR arms went into British affairs and politics? And can we slap those hands away from meddling?
Well, the European Court of Human Rights is not a real court in the common law tradition that Ireland would enjoy, the United Kingdom or Australia or the United States of America, with real judges and the cases being presented and argued out in front of a qualified judge who's worked his way up in the legal system. It's mainly, the European Court of Human Rights is mainly made up of political appointees, and of course, treats the European Convention, which is nothing wrong with the European Convention in itself, mm-hmm. is their interpretation of the European Convention on Human Rights. They regard it as a living document, and they read into it whatever they want, rather than thinking, well, what did the people want when they framed this document? Of course, it was British jurists that led the way in this. rather than thinking, what do they actually mean at the time? What were they actually trying to say? They regard it as a living document, and they will throw in anything that they want that's politically expedient. Of course, they didn't protect human rights when it came to the lockdowns and people being forced through compulsion and the threat of losing their jobs, as happened in the UK, those who are vaccinated for not taking the vaccine. They didn't protect their rights, but of course it will protect a political agenda that wants more mass migration, and of course a political agenda that is pushing the fallacy of global warming, which just isn't borne out by evidence at all, and is often the result of manipulation of computer programs, and in some cases a manipulation of data and a selective use of temperature readings at various times, such as after planes have just taken off, which is one instance, or a number of instances indeed, in the UK, all to try and spread this agenda, which means ultimately more power should be passed from ordinary working people to those at the very top. More power for those who are essentially exploiting people. Even Milton Friedman warned of this, that if their government control, more government control leads to more more abuses, that that those who are the most well off will be able to manipulate the system. And that's what global warming hysteria is actually really about. It's not for care of the environment. But of course, we now see the European Court of Human Rights saying that countries have a duty to enforce these policies, and they're somehow infringing on our human rights if they don't impose draconian taxes or restrict us from buying the cars that we would want, or forcing us to buy light bulbs that flicker and ruin some people's vision, for those who have photosensitive positions and health concerns. So really, the European Court of Human Rights is a political tool for the most powerful to push an agenda that is actually detrimental to ordinary working people in Britain, in Ireland, and across Europe as well.
I like the fact that you referenced that our human rights were completely trodden over and ignored during the scandemic years. And it seems to be not too many people bring that point up. By the way, Robert, it's nice to hear you say that here this morning. So for me, from what I can see anyway, this concept of human rights seems to be a switch that can be activated or deactivated depending on which agenda the government wishes to push. And just as we go up to the headline break, former MEP Bill Etheridge has said that the UK should be completely in control of its own laws after Brexit. And in a nutshell, why aren't they? Why aren't they? Brexit happened, but still we have this overreach and we have this long arm of the ECHR interfering in UK business or British business. So why do they still have that power? Why can't we just slap the hand away?
Well, Britain signed an exit agreement that has Section 29, that our laws still align to European Union laws, and we still have in force legacy EU rules which still apply, and they were meant to be done away with, but the government has ducked that challenge. Essentially, the government is absolutely weak in the face of what Mark Urban had called in American context the permanent government, or what other people would call the deep state, or we would just call the civil service, that want things done in a certain way, want to have as little change as possible, and want to water down any political agenda that they disagree with. And the power, the absolute sheer amount of power and money from rent-seeking corporations that have their own vested interest and don't want to see any change. They don't want to see Britain become a competitive market economy that could have new entrants coming in and competing with them. It's an opportunity to fix the system, and they've taken that opportunity with the European Union, and they don't want to see any real change. And despite the promises, the government has failed to deliver the actual changes that are indeed needed, such as getting rid of these legacy EU laws. We've got thousands of EU laws that are still in place that should be reviewed, that should be done away with, or amended, or fully repatriated and into the UK system, and then changed accordingly to suit our interests rather than those interests decided in Brussels by people we essentially haven't elected. Or, of course, the issue of the European Court of Human Rights based in Strasbourg, and initiating an agenda that's alien to our legal tradition and making absurd judgments in some cases, but at the very heart, it's undermining our democracy and the elected will of a government as expressed in its manifesto that wanted to deliver change, that was meant to deliver change, absolutely failed. And of course, that vote in the referendum nearly 8 years ago that wanted to put a stop to mass migration into the UK and wanted Britain, above all, to become a sovereign, independent, self-governing country, taking back control. That hasn't been done because of the clique essentially running the country. And of course, they'll soon be kicked out and another lot of baseless people will essentially be making exactly the same decisions that Rishi Sunak has been doing. No change. It's the old adage, you know, apparently there is a poster in the wall of a civil service department saying that if votes changed anything, we'd abolish them. That's, of course, that was no doubt is a joke, but well, is it? That's the question.
That's a good question. And on that, we'll pick up on that question because it's a question a lot more people are asking now than have ever asked, I believe, than at any other point in history. You know, is this legit? Is this a sham? Are we wasting our time as we come up to another general election before the end of January next year in the UK? So we've got to take a little headline break. Robert, when we come back at the other side, we'll look at that and what the implications might be if Starmer does get in. Will it actually be any different? Will it be out of the frying pan and into the fire? We'll look at that when we come back at the other side here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
Well, what's the news?
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The White House has stated that the United States will not participate in any counterstrike should Israel decide to retaliate following an attack on its territory by Iran. Quebec has experienced significant flooding due to heavy rainfall this week, particularly affecting rivers north of Montreal and in Quebec City. In Saint-Jérôme, located approximately 50 kilometers northwest of Montreal, officials reported major flooding on the Rivière du Nord.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
Okay, I'm talking this morning with Robert Oles, author and director of the Bruges Group. Robert, actually, I said we'll talk about elections and we will, but just before we get there, you mentioned the I word, this all-encompassing I word, immigration, mass immigration, illegal immigration, migration, asylum seeking, refugees, call it whatever you like. The bottom line is Ireland and the UK have a problem right now, and it's a problem that's not getting any better. Arguably, it's getting worse and worse, despite all the rhetoric that's coming from both the Irish government and the British government. Now, if I can go back a few years, Priti Patel, she said she was going to tackle this, reduce this down to zero. That didn't happen on her watch. Suella Braverman came in, said she was going to do the same thing. Obviously, Johnson, Rishi Sunak, we're going to address the small boats. We're going to stop this from happening. This is going to be sorted out. It hasn't. The country's still being awashed with people coming across the channel. In Ireland, we have exactly the same problems. Nowhere to put these people, no accommodation. There's no housing to put them into. They're going into hotels, army barracks, repurposed office blocks, call them what you want. The infrastructure's not there. This is plain to see, but yet we're told we need this. We need this in order for our country's economy to carry on. Are people actually, in your opinion, buying that narrative now? Or from what I can see in Ireland, most villages and towns are now out protesting at the weekends. Old women, children, mothers and fathers, they're not right-wing extremists with balaclavas and petrol bombs. These are people that are deeply concerned about their communities. Surely this fake lie narrative of the government must collapse imminently because there's just nowhere else to put these people that are coming into the country.
Ireland and the Irish people and the protests that they've been so bravely undertaking, despite much criticism from their own representatives in the Dáil who should be representing them, and of course, no doubt the Taoiseach as well, and other government ministers and their response has been to crack down on freedom of speech and try and take more control over people's lives. But Ireland has been very, very brave in standing up to what's happening. Because Ireland is relatively a small country that's facing a massive amount of immigration. And it would just take a relatively small proportion of people to come to change the culture of Ireland together. Of course, already in Galway, rural West Ireland, the most popular baby name is, of course, Mohammed. That's a change that is enormous in terms of its magnitude, the cultural shift. And, of course, we see the safety of people protected. And then Irish heroes who would talk and warn about the problem, such as people like Conor McGregor, people who are beacons of support in Ireland, have been slapped down and threatened with prosecution for raising the alarm about safety on the streets. And, of course, it's not any different to any other country. Now, of course, you mentioned that we're told it's for our own good. Well, there's evidence from the Netherlands where people of certain backgrounds, immigrants, never actually become economically beneficial to the host country. Of course, some from other backgrounds will, of course, become the new overclass in terms of their family upbringing, their values in education, and their ability to succeed will surpass, and they will take many of the opportunities that will otherwise be presented to people of an indigenous background, perhaps. But of course, there's still this growing underclass of people who will never become net economic contributors. And normal people can see the pressures on their education, on their places getting school places, doctors' surgeries, and of course the pressure for rising house prices and rising rents and less availability. There's a great deal of inflation and wealth inequality in Ireland, and this is actually making it worse. And of course, the same in the UK is actually we're importing poverty. That's what's actually having pressure on services that can't keep up, and of course, more cost for those who were already in this country and who should no doubt have the priority. Surely we should be investing in our own people rather than importing the world's problems. And then there's the cultural issue. Of course, Ireland and Britain, we have a long tradition of valuing individual liberty and protecting people's dignity and human rights and safe protection of people going about their daily business. Some people in other countries don't share exactly those values and come from very troubled lands. And as we've seen with the grooming gang scandal within the UK and in northern towns in England, the safety of many people, particularly women, is something to be concerned of. And it's the same in France and across Europe that follow this similar pattern. And this is a cultural change. And we could see indeed in the future those values that we hold so dear wiped out potentially. It could indeed change. The projections are with, of course, that the pressures, the economic system leading to lower birth rates of those who are indigenous, and then the importation of people from a different background will have, of course, more children. Then the projections are that both Britain and Ireland will change fundamentally into the future. And we can't be sure that it will be for the better. Indeed, the evidence is suggesting that it will be much for the worse. So that's absolutely something that we need to be very alarmed of. And we need to get control back in terms of our borders. But of course, it starts with getting control back over our governments, who are absolutely ignoring us and a part of, in a sense, more of a cabal, really, meeting in Davos and agreeing things. They're not deciding things in Brussels behind closed doors. They're deciding things in Davos behind closed doors to the detriment of their existing citizens.
Yeah, they're without a doubt rogue. The governments of Ireland and the UK and Great Britain are rogue governments. There's no two ways about it. I mean, like, listening to you talking, you're making your points very clearly. My opinion's the same. I don't have a problem with people coming, moving between countries to work, or if they're genuinely fleeing from persecution and there is a capacity for the host country to receive them without them stepping over people in that country that already have needs, for example, homeless people or veterans that are living on the streets. Well, if the capacity's there and it's legit and we can do it, then yeah, let's help some people out. But I don't know about you, but I'm looking around Ireland, where I live in the north of Ireland here in Northern Ireland, and I'm seeing a lot of deprivation. I'm seeing a lot of people struggling, and I'm seeing the government not looking after their own people. And if you can't look after your own people, how are you going to look after people that are coming in from another country, very many of whom, by the way, are entering the country illegally with no documentation, no evidence, cock and bull stories about where they're from or where they're fleeing from in many cases. Just something doesn't add up with this. And I agree, Robert, if something's not done about this, I believe it's a treacherous act. The governments are acting treacherously towards the people that they're supposed to represent. And this can only go one way. And this is just taking us right off the edge of the cliff. But that's a discussion maybe for another time, because we're out of time right now. I feel we're just getting warmed up here. I feel we could go another few rounds here, but we can't, because I've got to take a break, do an ad, and then bring Basil Valentine on, which I'm happy to do also. But Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, hearing what your views are and your opinions here. Maybe we'll get to talk again about some of the contents of those books that you have produced, as well as looking at the ongoing developing political situation here in the UK and Ireland. So that's Robert Olds. Please show your appreciation for him. Leave a message in the live chat, and hopefully we'll talk again sooner rather than later. So we've got to take a break right now, and Basil Valentine will be back at the other side with a breakdown of what's happening in the Middle East at the minute over the weekend here on TNT, Today's News Talk.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Pre-retirement? Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pre-retirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Oh. Potential tax breaks?
Yep. Boo.
Oh, I could build up savings for my side hustle. This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Right, I've got cancer. I've been trying to tell the rest of you, but no one's listening. And I don't just mean you, ears, eyes. Would you look in the damn toilet for once? Hands, roll those sleeves and take a sample. And legs, trot off to the doctor to get me looked at. Because bowel cancer can be successfully treated when detected early. Now look who's finally woken up.
Informative and engaging. Rick Munn. Rick Munn on Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, it's Monday, the 15th of April, 2024, TNT, locked and loaded, live, uncensored, unscripted, and all that jazz. I'm very happy to be joined again this fresh spring morning by the one and only Basil Valentine, our political editor. Basil, how are you doing? How's the weekend been? And more importantly, did you net yourself a few quid on the National over the weekend?
Good morning, Rick. Great to see you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. No, unfortunately, I didn't back the winner of the Grand National. He was the 7-1 joint favourite. In a field of 34... where the average price should therefore be 33-1, I don't tend to back 7-1 favourites, but he won it very easily. I am Maximus, trained over on your side of the water, Rick, by the Irish maestro Willie Mullins, who looks set to become champion national hunt trainer in Britain, even though he's based in Ireland. He's only had about 20-odd winners in Britain, but they've been all the big races. He's won the Champion Hurdle, the Gold Cup, and now the Grand National. And the Trainers' Championship runs for 9 weeks. So he's firing bullets at the Scottish Grand National on Saturday. And then the final big meeting of the season at Sandown. But I digress. It would be wonderful if all we had to talk about was horse racing on this extremely windy morning down here on the South Coast. You'd never know it was spring. But at least we're not waking up to the warm glow of thermonuclear radiation fallout, which looked as if it might be the case at one point over the weekend.
Yeah, this business of the weekend, obviously, things are really heating up again in the Middle East, this time between Iran and Israel. And of course, we've been commentating and speculating now for the last, 6 months since October last year, that really one of the goals here is to drag Iran into this one. So obviously, they launched a retaliatory strike on Israel over the weekend. Drone strikes, rocket strikes, we saw the skies lit up. A lot of people sitting on the edge of their seats thinking, is this it? Is this going to kick off Armageddon? Is this going to be World War III? Are the nukes going to be coming in? Well, obviously, that hasn't happened yet, but tensions continue to mount over there, Basil. What's your analysis of the weekend's events thus far?
Well, the first thing I want to mention is that 68 people were killed in the Middle East over the last 24 hours in what may constitute a crime against humanity. Where were they killed, Rick? They were killed in Gaza. They were civilians attempting to return to their homes, or what's left of their homes, in northern Gaza from the south. And they were targeted directly with artillery shells and live bullets by the Israeli army. You wouldn't think so, judging from the headlines and all the coverage over the weekend, which focused on this, you know, terrible attack on Israel and, you know, what, you know, alarm amongst the Israeli civilian population. What Israel experienced over the weekend was a pinprick compared to the machete attack that the Gazans have suffered. So we need to get these things into perspective.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the British politicians, you know, are very, very quick to talk about Israel's right to defend itself and this unprecedented attack and all that. But, you know, the Iranians were responding to the bombing of their consulate in Damascus, something they actually have every right to do under international law. They were extremely aggrieved that that attack was not condemned in Western capitals. Something, you know, whatever you think of the Iranian regime or what life is like over there, breaking the Vienna Convention as egregiously as the Israelis did, killing two generals and five other members of staff, is a gross violation of international law. And the Iranians, as a result, have, believe it or not, the legal right under international law to respond, which I believe they did proportionally. Nobody was killed in the Iranian response. No one was killed. That's why Joe Biden is reportedly telling Benjamin Netanyahu to take the win. In terms of casualties, it's 7-0 to the Israelis. They killed seven Iranians. The Iranians haven't killed any Israelis in response. Now is the pivotal moment, right now. An Iranian response of the kind that was delivered over the weekend was always expected. What we don't know is whether the Israelis are now going to retaliate further. Both sides are sort of claiming victory in a way. The Royal Air Force and the United States helped shoot down 99% of the Iranian drones over Jordan. A lot of the Arab world, certainly civilian populations in the Arab world, are very angry with the Jordanian king in particular for allowing Jordanian airspace to be used by the RAF and US forces to shoot down the drones. 99% were intercepted. So Israel is sort of claiming a win. On the other hand, the Iranians are also claiming that they carried out their mission successfully and it accomplished its goals. So we're back in the sort of stalemate that we were in prior to the Israeli attack on the consulate. If they then want, if the Israelis decide now they want to retaliate by directly attacking Iranian soil, not just a diplomatic mission somewhere else or their proxies in Lebanon, then we could be in for all-out war. Now, last week, Israel Katz, the Israeli foreign minister, said, if Iran launches an attack from Iranian soil, we will retaliate with an attack on, you know, the sovereign territory of Iran itself. the United States have said they will not follow the Israelis in on such an attack while they are willing to help them defend Israel with the Iron Dome and all the rest of it. They're not willing to attack Iran in conjunction with the Israelis. So we're at a stalemate. The Israeli war cabinet met this morning and the meeting broke up without a decision about what to do next. And for the rest of the world, for the time being, that's the best thing, because I think the longer they leave it, the harder it'll be for the Israelis to retaliate militarily. And we all have to hope they don't, because that could lead to all-out war.
Basil, if I can rewind this business back 4 years and 3 months, all right, I can remember, just straight off the top of my head, something that really struck me, something that happened in January of 2020. And in January of 2020, I wasn't a follower of politics and world events at the time, but there was a huge tension at the time when Donald Trump, the then US president, killed a very high-ranking and beloved Iranian general. I believe his name was Qasem Soleimani or Soleimani, at an Iraqi airport back in January of 2020. And I can remember at the time going into work that day in my normal job and talking to my normal, you know, average everyday work colleagues. And the talk at the time was the tensions were so high back then that we could be on the verge of World War III. And of course, that's not anything new. The doomsday clock has been at two minutes to midnight for a very, very long time. But there are peaks, I believe, of tension. And when Trump killed Soleimani, I can remember his funeral. There was about 1, maybe 2 million people at that funeral. And there was some special mosque that they had this black flag raised halfway up as a sign that jihad was imminent. And they were calling for American blood and for Israel to be eradicated off the face of the map. That was back in January of 2020. And tensions were so high that for a few days, all the eyes of the world were on Iran at the time to see what will they do next. Now, they did launch a retaliatory strike. Again, from memory, I believe they launched some missiles at some American air bases. There were no casualties. Nobody was killed. But they didn't forget that. And sometimes, you know, silence is a precursor for something catastrophic. They say in prison, okay, if you ever go to prison, Basil, and someone's talking to you a lot, threatening you, if they go silent all of a sudden, understand that a physical attack is imminent. So I'm watching with intent here what's going on in the Middle East. There's no casualties, as you rightly said, in Iran's drone strikes over the weekend. But I dare say there's a lot of lingering memories there and a lot of extremely bad blood between Iran and Israel and Iran and the US and whatnot. And won't be forgotten about quickly.
No, certainly not. There was one casualty in Israel, apparently. A 7-year-old girl was wounded. Are the Israelis going to launch World War III because one girl was wounded? Hopefully not. That would represent, you know, some kind of insanity. But unfortunately, you know, that's where we are. I'm not sure that we're really dealing with rational actors on either side. All the rhetoric coming out of the UK, for example, David Cameron, is 100% behind the Israelis. They seem to ignore the fact that the Iranian attack was, you know, only occurred because the Israelis bombed the embassy in Damascus, targeting an individual, General Mohammed, who the Israeli intelligence claim was the guy who gave the thumbs up, the green light to October the 7th. I've also heard that it was expected that on October the 7th, Hezbollah were going to attack Israel simultaneously from the north, as was Syria, but that the Russians used their influence in the region to stay Hezbollah and Syria's hand and say, look, no, don't. You know, don't go in. As a result, Hamas were left on their own. I can't verify that, but that, you know, that's the word on the street, as it were. But back to David Cameron, he described it as a reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done, and added that it was a double defeat as it had failed to inflict damage on Israel, and that they've revealed to the world that they are the malign influence in the region. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. A lot of people are saying that Cameron is acting as the de facto prime minister because his words seem to carry more weight than the feeble Rishi Sunak, who issued a pathetic statement. I mean, both Starmer and Sunak issued statements that frankly could have been written in Tel Aviv over the weekend. There was no reference whatsoever to the fact that the Iranians were retaliating for an attack on what is their sovereign territory. A consulate is the sovereign territory of the country it represents.
Obviously, there's a lot of people being affected by this business directly, Basil, the people that are on the ground in those places. But when any war kicks off, the ripples are felt all around the world, if not physically, but socially and also economically as well. Now, interesting here, there's an article that came out. Oil prices have actually dropped after the Iranian attack on Israel. So obviously there was concern that oil prices would skyrocket up immediately following this attack. They've actually dropped. The reason being, apparently, prices had already risen in expectation of action by Iran, with Brent crude nearing a six-month high last week. Analysts said the markets would be looking to see now how the conflict could affect global supply chains. So oil price fluctuations can cause ripple effects across the world due to companies being heavily reliant upon the commodity, which is used to produce fuels such as petrol and diesel. So what this article is basically saying is they had priced in some Iranian action into last week's increased oil prices. Now they've seen what's happened. They're now saying that the determining factor on how this one will go will be any retaliation by Israel at this point in time. So the ball very much is in their court in many, many ways, Basil, and how they play that ball could have serious, serious effects on not just the area and the people living in the area in terms of attacks and bombs and ordnance, but also right across the world when it comes to oil prices, whenever we're pretty much all struggling to begin with at the minute. The last thing we need now is another spike, Ukraine, February 2022 style, where oil prices and gas prices nearly, you know, went up 60, 70, 80% in some cases over the space of 4 weeks.
Well, it's time for sanity to prevail, Rick. You know, that's the key thing. There were heated words yesterday between Iran and Israel at the UN Security Council meeting, with their representatives both calling on the council to impose sanctions on each other. Iran's ambassador said his country's actions were necessary and proportionate, and added that the Security Council failed in its duty to maintain international peace and security because it didn't condemn the original Israeli attack. And that's a very good point. You know, any attack on a diplomatic mission has to be condemned. It's as simple as that. Otherwise, all the so-called rules-based order or international law, whatever it is, has no meaning whatsoever. And he added that Tehran had no choice but to respond, adding that his country does not seek escalation or war, but will respond to any threat or aggression. On the other hand, Israel's UN ambassador Gilad Erdan told the meeting that Iran is the number one global sponsor of terror and a pirate state. I mean, you've got to admire the chutzpah, haven't you? 15,000 children murdered, absolutely apocalyptic scenes in Gaza, an absolute hell on earth there, which is why civilians are trying to walk back to the north. There are pictures online, you know, children clutching what few possessions they have in rags, you know, scenes as abysmal as anything I've ever seen. And yet Erdan has the gall to claim Iran is the number one global sponsor of terror. Iran has not killed 15,000 children and mutilated thousands of others in the last 6 months. Israel has. So, you know, the double standards, this is the thing that irritates the Iranians, and indeed to a lesser extent. So, you know, the double standards, this is the thing that irritates the Iranians, and indeed to a lesser extent the Russians and Chinese, is the double standards displayed by the West. You know, suddenly it's all about international law when it suits them, and not when it doesn't. It's an echo, really, of at what you were talking about with Robert Ould's. You know, human rights are tremendously important when they are certain people and certain rights are violated and not with others. But it's to be hoped that, you know, that this will now, this row will now be confined to the Security Council. It's much better that they're, it's jaw in New York rather than war in the Middle East. And Dawood Qutab, writing in Al Jazeera this morning, has pointed out in an opinion piece, amid the Israel-Iran escalation, it's time for a region-wide ceasefire. And, you know, anybody half sensible would echo that position, Rick.
Yeah, half sensible, but unfortunately, we don't even have people with half sensibilities occupying positions that make these decisions. Dodgy Dave Cameron, fishy Rishi Sunak too in particular, and of course, crazy Benjamin Netanyahu also. So no doubt this will continue to develop through the week. Basil, thank you so much for your input. We've got a call time in this one right now, but we will talk again tomorrow here, live, uncensored, unscripted on TNT. Locked and Loaded. We'll be right back after you.